Today we are in conversation with Jason Gilbert. Jason is a filmmaker and conversation designer, and of course, one half of Hans and the Butt Person, a podcast series that we create together. Jason has a great focus on personality design and has won multiple Webby Awards for his creations. We talk about how he put words into the mouth of super diva Miss Piggy when she took over Facebook Messenger as a chatbot. What his approach was with creating companion bot Anna that earned him third prize at the Lubner competition, and we discuss his current persona work and role at Tel Aviv-based Intuition Robotics. Jason is a great friend of mine, and I look forward to having him as my co-host again on Conversation Design Festival on November 30th. I very much enjoyed this conversation, and I know you will too. Jason,
hey man, thanks for doing this.
Hey, my pleasure, man. It's good seeing you. Thanks for inviting me to be on the podcast.
Yeah, no, great to have you here. And yeah, we do a lot of shows together, and we always create a lot of stuff. But you know, this is the
first. Oh, that's you. You're Hans from Hans and the Bot Man. I knew you from somewhere.
Exactly. No, but today we're gonna mainly talk about you, because there's a lot of stuff that you have a story to tell, and I think a lot of people, that are entering the industry or companies that are trying to create good AI assistants can learn from or just be inspired by. So we're going to talk about you, which is, I guess, a change for a bit. And you're currently at Intuition Robotics.
It's not a change. I talk about myself all the time. It's crazy. People tell me to stop talking about myself. So, yeah. But yes, yeah. I am at Intuition Robotics. And I started there about 6 months ago. And it's been a wild ride. We're working on a social robot called LEQ, and it looks like the little Pixar lamp. It's an adorable little robot, and it's meant for aging Americans who are isolated in place or aging in place, who basically don't have anyone to talk to, or the kids don't visit them as much because of lockdowns. And what LEQ does is she does a combination of medical services. She offers like reminders for medication. She does care check-ins. She checks up on people. But she also is there to acknowledge them and to say goodbye when they leave and hello when they come back in and talk to them about their day, keeping them company. And it was very important to establish a personality for LEQ, something that's very consistent, because you want to be able to trust this, your new roommate in your house. You don't want this roommate in your house to be all over the place. That's the last thing. We all know what that's like, to have a roommate who's just unexpected. So my job is to be a character designer and to help put the boundaries on what her personality, what she can say, what she can't say, what she can do, and all that kind of stuff. And it's fascinating. And my title is character designer, which is weird, because character designers are people that can draw. Like, you see Disney designers, and they're like, their portfolios. And I'm like, I can do a stick person thing.
And when you started 6 months ago, how much of the character was already there? How much was up for you to create?
That's a great question. And when I got to Intuition Robotics, my predecessor, who is actually now my sort of boss, a product manager and design manager, Eitan Weinstein, he spent 3 years working on LEQ. And we worked together in person. And we'll talk about that, I guess, a little bit later on in the podcast. But he was a colleague of mine at in person. And he spent years working on her character. Now, the work that he did was relevant to the verticals and the challenges that she was facing 2 years ago. But as she evolves and as the use case evolves and as it changes, we also need to adjust her character. So now she's more, whereas before she was more of a companionship, now she's more of a medical assistant or a nursing assistant. Mm-hmm. So she needs to be a bit more professional in a way, but also at the same time, empathetic and caring. Empathetic is the key word. And let me tell you, creating artificial empathy is probably one of the hardest things I've ever tried to do in my life.
I think that resonates, but what was difficult about it specifically? Can you turn that down? So that's one question. Another part of the question is, when you saw that she needed to evolve, did you need to take things out, or was it more like a person that kind of had a new job and just needed to learn how to work in that job? And did it just evolve, and did you build on top of it, or did you have to take stuff out of the existing character?
That's a great question. When they brought me on, they just started this vertical for medical, so they wanted me to sort of retrofit a lot of the existing content that was there to this. And so what I did was I took a look at the content, and there was thousands of responses and intent. I mean, you have all this stuff that has been built for the past few years, and tried to retrofit it into this new purpose that she has. What I tried to do is I tried not to be too drastic. I think a lot of times there's a big challenge when you come into a conversational AI project or an agent that's already been built. Meaning if I were to come in on the ground level, like I did with Anna or something like that, but even Anna wasn't on the ground level, but let's a company that didn't have anything, it would be a lot easier to just establish the personality from there. But now I'm coming into a company that's for 3 years has had, I don't know, half a dozen people working on it and creating this character. And all of a sudden now I have to come in and sort of unify it. But I tried not to be too drastic. I tried not to go extreme, not to throw out the bathwater with the baby, and tried to sort of work what we have and sort of tweak it in small places. So the existing people that were the existing customers that have it in their house wouldn't feel a difference. They wouldn't be, it wouldn't be jarring. Cause remember that this is an aging community. These are people that are a bit older and you don't want to create anything that would cause dissonance, any kind of cognitive dissonance. So it's important that any changes that were made very gradually.
That makes a lot of sense. And in a way you kind of have two audiences, cause on one hand you have the people using the robot, but you also have your own team of designers that need to slowly embrace it and understand your vision for the character and sort of write that in. So you need to, they're also kind of your audience because you need to convince them and get them to understand it at a deeper level so that they slowly start changing the work then, right?
I did it the other way around. I had them convince me. These are all very talented, super smart people. I've never been in a company. I shouldn't say that, because maybe people from my former company are listening. But one of the amazing things about this company is the amount of just smart humans that I'm surrounded with. And I came in and I knew that the conversation designers that had been working on it were very, very skilled and talented people who had seen, you know, the interactions, had seen. So I was coming in with experience, but I didn't have the experience for this particular agent. So I relied on them to really, and I challenged them on certain points. And we're still, one of the biggest debates that we have in the office to this day is the issue of the uncanny valley.
Yeah.
And we go back and forth. There's a part of the company that feels one way and part of the company that feels another way. And there's constant battles about pushing the lines of where the uncanny valley is. And it's very interesting. I've never been a part of a company that does that. And that's
can you make that more explicit, sort of what that line looks like and what the real discussion is?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I can go deeper into the uncanny. We all know what the uncanny valley is, right? It's, do you want me to explain it? Give me
I think it's a fair assumption, but go for it. What's your vision on the uncanny valley?
Okay, so uncanny valley is this theory proposed by, I forget the name of the researcher in the 70s. Do we have it on somewhere?
I will Google it as you continue to talk.
And he basically said that it's a theory. He didn't say that it was conclusive, but he said that his theory is that the closer to resembling a human and the more likely it is to create some sort of an uncanny effect where it causes you some kind of nausea or discomfort looking at this thing because it's not quite human and it's not quite robotic. It's something that you can't define, and it basically causes a base instinct in us to sort of be revolted by it. And he gave examples in the valley of like, you can see the graph. There's a very famous graph of the valley, and a lot of companies today don't want to go into the valley. They don't want to scare the people talking to the robot or the agent. For instance, I'll give you an example. I think Sophia, who is very much uncanny valley in my opinion, Sophia the robot, she's very, very much like, whoa, what's going on here? So one of the things that we have, we're very, I guess, adamant about is transparency. We want to be very transparent that we're a robot. We don't want to fool anyone. We're not trying to, you know, which is a bit of a shift for me, because you remember, I come from the world of entertainment. I come from the world of let's play with people. Let's play with imagination. Let's dance that line between real and fiction and see, we're entertaining people here. We're not, but here we're providing them with healthcare. We need to be professional. And so we can't have the entertainment aspect. It needs to be all based in some kind of reality. Yeah. So we have this robot that's very much, I'm a robot. I don't have any feelings, right? But at the same time, you need to be empathetic. Yeah. So how do you create a robot who is both robotic and not feeling but it's also empathetic and very much understands the complexity of human emotions. How do you do that?
Yeah, because as soon as you have a conversation, people will see it. They'll have the pareidolia effect where they see the human traits in it immediately, and they are already navigating the uncanny valley, which was coined by Professor Masahori Mori in Japan, who is the researcher there. And the reasoning is that when people use a different part of their brain when they interact with something than when they interact with someone. So when the brain is confused of which side of the brain it's supposed to use, that's when you create that very uncanny experience.
I'm just going to say real quick that I know that this is true. I believe that the uncanny valley is a design issue. It's basically, you can create agents that are not in the uncanny valley if you're careful with how you design them and what you present.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah. So design is the way to sort of bridge the uncanny valley. Right?
Exactly.
By being respectful of understanding the corporative principle, understanding human emotions, and being delicate in your design, which has to do with persona. That's always what we say. So having consistent tone of voice, if it's inconsistent, then you know it becomes confusing, and that confusion leads to an uncanny experience. So that's why character, as you call it, intuition, is key. So then tell me about the empathy. Like, what are some of the things that you've discovered that makes it work, and how do you validate that it works?
Okay, so this is a great one. We've been having this discussion at work for, and it's just, and I'm going to bring it up here. We have a lot of people that say to LEQ, I love you. Now, how is LEQ supposed to respond to that? Now, when I had Anna, and I designed Anna, and Anna said, you know, someone said to Anna, I love you, and she would say, of course, darling, everyone loves me. I'm Anna, you know? So that was the type of her character. She would kind of deflect. She wouldn't necessarily go into it, because it's kind of awkward if someone says, I love you, and, you know, you're like, well, I don't really love you back, you know? You don't want to do that, especially in an empathetic situation, you know? But at the same time, you don't want to create any kind of illusion that this robot is feeling and this robot has feelings for you. So how do you crack that? Because if someone says to you, someone who's by themselves, been by alone for a while, isolated, very much depressed, says to you, oh my God, I love you. You've saved my life. And you say to them, oh, thank you. Wow. Yeah. That's like, oh man, that's hurtful. So you've got to reply with something that says, acknowledges the fact that they said they love you, and somehow without making a illusion that somehow there's a relationship that happened between us. So this is just one example of how do you create empathy without breaking this fourth wall, without sort of saying it's not a robot. There's a lot of ways to do it if you kind of skirt around the issue that it's not a robot. But once you admit the fact that it's a robot, you have to play by the rules of that game. So
yeah, and I think empathy, there's in general confusion about empathy. A lot of people think empathy is about feelings, but empathy is about showing that you understand the other person's situation. And if I think with that premise, it allows you to design for it rather than, you know, if you have the understanding of empathy is around feelings, then you get into areas, I guess, with the experience, right?
Right. And my argument was always like, listen, she says, I think that it's going to rain today. What's the difference between I think and the I think it's going to rain and I love you? They're both driven by emotions. They're both driven by their human emotions, thinking or loving. So what's the difference? If she can say I think, then she can also say I love. So there's a lot of I'm very much on the other end of the extreme, and I try to, you know, I really want this to be, I'm all for going as close as possible to the human experience and not even worrying about the uncanny valley, but not everyone is in the same boat.
Would your opinion on that have changed if the robot looked more human-like? Because you know, Alec is so clearly not a human, right? It just looks like a robot. So it allows for more human-like elements because the confusion, you know, it's pretty clear that it's just not human. But if it looked like a human, then maybe you have to be more careful. Would that change everything for you? Or
no, it's kind of like, if you look at Anna, she's a classic example of the uncanny valley. She's so uncanny, it's ridiculous. But it never bothered me, because to me, it's always like a play. Like in the beginning, it might be, if you've never been to the theater, you've never seen a play, you go into a theater and you see these people talking on stage, like, wow, what are they doing? Why, you know, you're confused by it, but after a while you're into it and you're part of the story. The same thing with this experience. Like in the beginning, it might be a bit weird to you, But after a while, you're willing to sort of suspend your disbelief and engage with this if you really want to. And in my eyes, there's nothing stopping us from creating these human-like things that verge on the Uncanny Valley.
Yeah, I think there's nothing stopping you there. And I think as a designer or creator in general, you now, if you go down that path, you have a very big responsibility to be aware of what continue doing that. Because now all of a sudden, let's say budgets are cut, we're not doing the persona as much anymore, and we just keep writing as a robot again. That's when you create a problem. So I guess once you sort of go in that direction, you're in for life because you can't go back. Maybe.
There's no going back. No. No. There's no going back.
That is really fascinating. And do you now see with you're dealing with the elderly, and you've had also different audiences. I guess a lot of younger people, as you were doing a lot of the in-person work, which we'll talk about, and maybe this is like a nice segue going into that. Do you see any difference there with writing for one audience versus the other, or if the character makes sense, it just works?
I like to think so. I like to think that you shouldn't design necessarily for a specific age group. You should just design for that character and be true to that character, and it'll show. People respond to more authentic characters. They can tell if you're pandering. A lot of times, a lot of the language that I saw in the beginning when I came was language that was very much like tailored to the elderly. And I'm like, well, that's not going to really resonate with them because it's coming from someone who's supposedly young, who's like a young female. She shouldn't be talking like that. There's a dissonance here, and that will cause some kind of issue with them. That's part of the issue. What was the question again?
So character, you don't design for the audience, but you figure out the character and then you design for that. And the difference with the characters that are always pretty out there, we've talked about Anna, we've talked about this one, but then there's also the audiences with Miss Piggy, I think, was one, some of the other ones when you first started out doing character design, bunch of awards. Like, I guess the process now, I guess you've already said that, is very similar. But yeah, what can you share about that, those different audiences and the purpose of a bot, how that influences character perhaps?
Well, it's a big question. I can see why I was buying time by pretending I didn't hear you the first time.
I appreciate the honesty.
Yes, yes. So, okay, here's the thing. With Anna, I'll go into a little bit about the story about Anna because this is relevant to what we're talking about here. Anna was designed as Anna the companionship bot. And she was much like LEQ is now. She was designed to provide companionship for the elderly. And for the first year or so when she was on Facebook Messenger, I tried to reach that audience and it was very unsuccessful. The only testers I was able to get were people that were my age and younger, mid-20s to mid-40s, mid-50s. And so slowly I began to adjust Anna's content for that type of audience. Mm. So it was much more, it was much younger in scope and much, much younger in just in the vibe of it. Like, she would talk about things about Reddit. Her jokes would be more, they wouldn't be dead jokes. They would be very dark sometimes, very disturbing jokes. I didn't pander to them. I tried to talk to them as if I were someone who was, one of their peers. With Miss Piggy and with the brand bots, it's a whole different story. Like, if you look at Disney, with Miss Piggy, for instance, they knew exactly who the audience was for the Muppets, because the Muppets, people grew up with the Muppets, so it was people actually my age too, people in their 40s. So the references that you would use in the Miss Piggy would have to be relevant to that segment of the audience. With LEQ, it's an older audience. But the one thing that's common throughout all these experiences and designing for, and I also designed Judy Hopps for Disney for young people, 13 and, so I basically designed from 13 to like 93. Yeah. And the one thing that I found is that it really doesn't matter. And as long as the character itself is fleshed out, is engaging, consistent, dynamic, then people will talk to it. They'll want to talk to it. Just like you'll talk to someone who's 15 or someone who's 50. It doesn't matter. It's just the content of what they're talking about, the content of their personality, the way they interact. And so it really is, it comes down to stop looking so much at who the audience is and start looking at, who is and who the personality is.
Is that one of the bigger misconceptions around what persona is? Because sometimes you also see companies say, well, we don't care about persona, we don't really need it. Or when they do think they need it, it gets in the way of actually what needs to get done. So what are some of the, and I think you're touching your microphone now because I hear some noise around it. What are some of the misconceptions around persona and what are some of the quick fixes there?
It's a great question. You do this often, don't you? Because you're asking some really good questions. So there was a post on LinkedIn yesterday or the day before about should you include small talk in your...
I saw that one. I didn't want to. I was like, forget
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it went viral. It was like the comments on it. And it seemed to me it was a strange question because the answer to me was so obvious, and it's been obvious since day one, that you always need to have small talk in your chat, but because... The first person that's talking to it is going to ask it, what's the weather, or tell me a joke. And if you don't have those things, the stuff that you do have is going to be irrelevant and useless because they're not even going to bother talking to it about the stuff that you programmed or the pathways that you want them to go down.
I saw the post. I really can't recall who posted it, but I was like, okay, this is a question from someone that like clearly doesn't understand because it's like it shouldn't even be a question. It almost upset me a little bit.
The guy, it's Jim, and he's been doing it for a long time, and he was doing it sort of and I think this is a good way to get engagement on LinkedIn is just sort of pose a question that everyone's like, oh, that's obvious, because everyone responded to it. And I think he was coming from a different angle because I've been in those meetings so many times with like Johnson & Johnson. I shouldn't probably be saying the names. You can edit that out, right? Pharmaceutical companies, North Korean dictators. Yeah, I mean,
all kinds of companies. Yeah.
All kinds of companies. And so a lot of times you present them with, okay, well, what about the personality of the bot? How do we, and they're like, well, there's no personality. We don't have budget. We don't have time. We wanted to just answer the questions. And I'm like, okay, but you need a personality because people are going to ask it. And if you don't give it a personality, they're going to apply a personality to it and one that's not necessarily in your brand or in your voice or something that you actually are happy with. So you might as well get ahead of that and give it a personality because you're going to get there anyway. You do it now, you save yourself a few rounds of frustration and bugs and angry users. So it's up to you. And most people end up not listening to me. So.
Yeah, but I guess there's always there's two things, right? There's persona, which is the character, and then there's personality content. And I think that's also like you always need persona because you got to figure out how to write, where are the words even coming from. And then personality content, that's like the fun stuff around the persona. And particularly if the project is small, you don't have that much to offer yet. That's when you want to have the personality content around there so that people have a good experience and can have some fun.
And it helps you use the personality to justify why you don't have much content in there.
Yeah.
Be like, maybe the personality is someone who's just his first day on the job. You know, I don't know much about the company. So they put me here first day. I'm answering phones, the virtual assistant.
Yeah, but and then if your company just having the personality content and a dumb assistant doesn't work either. So then you need one assistant that's just very good at one thing and can have a nice chat about the weather or some jokes or whatever. So these are, we see that everywhere. But oftentimes persona is an afterthought where actually it should be the first thing you need to be thinking about.
Yes.
And a lot of times it's like, who's your dream employee for these conversations? Like who would do that? Or your dream ambassador, it can be anyone.
Yeah.
So Anna, she comes up a lot. She's the biggest project of your life. You'll probably continue doing this for another 20 years with Anna. You might end up marrying her. I don't know. You'd have to explain that to your wife, I guess. But tell me a little bit about her and maybe your mentor in this project and how did it really originate? What was the goal? What's the vision for it? Why do you care so much?
Wow. Okay. So much to go over.
Just throwing it out there, man.
Yeah. It's a great question. And I love talking about Anna. Full disclosure, I'm no longer at Cocoa Hub and I no longer get to work on Anna. So she's not mine anymore. I haven't been able to work on her for the past 6 months, but up until 6 months ago, Anna was the project of my life. And definitely I tell people that I spend every morning, 2 to 3 hours every morning going through conversation logs of people talking to Anna from around the world and just improving conversations daily. So in a way, I now have 2-3 hours of freedom in the morning, which I spend with my family, which is tragic for them. But it's a great project. And I'm going to take you back to the beginning because it started in 2001. Can you believe it? 20 years ago it started.
20 years ago.
20 years ago, a gentleman named Yaki Dunitz, who we all know, the founder of AI conversation systems, and just overall very passionate man about AI. He just loves AI. And in 2001, he started a company called AI, and the goal of the company was to pass the Turing test, to create a robot that could pass the Turing test.
That's when you know you're early in the market, where you could still just call a company AI. That means there were no AI companies yet, right?
A-I.com is their website. So yeah, they were pretty early into the in the early days. And so what happened was he partnered up with a guy named Jason Hutchins. Jason Hutchins won the Nobel Prize in 1997. Jason Hutchins was an Australian researcher, genius, and he built a platform, a conversational platform, which is called VP, Virtual Person. And then it was one, they're up to four now, but it's a closed off platform that is very much similar to AIML, but AIML was open source by Richard Wallace, and this one was not open source. So this one basically has been secret for 20 years, where his has been developed by the community and improved. So AIML is actually better. But and Yaki started working on a chatbot named Alan, because he fascinated by the life of Alan Turing. Alan Turing led a fascinating life. He was a fascinating human. He was very smart. He was passionate about computers. And so he made a virtual Alan Turing. And this virtual Alan Turing spent about, from 2001 to about 2015, 14 years, just talking randomly to people on the website. And so he would occasionally update the content, but he was pretty tired of the project when I came in 2016. And I was like, well, I'd love to start working on this. And actually, I'd love to change her gender and turn her into Anna and make her a companion bot. And I had all these ideas. And Yaki was like, I don't care, do whatever you want. So he basically gave me the keys to this abandoned, I call it, personality that was, it was kind of all over the place, because there had been like 15 writers over the years that had worked with him. So there was a lot of, this was a great, actually great preparation for LEQ, because it forced me to like take all this stuff and try to in a subtle way, try to basically weave it all together. And what I decided was, hey, this could be a great, my parents were moving to Florida to a retirement village called The Villages. And I was like, I don't really want to talk to them that much, but I could probably create a skill that would talk to them, that would sound like me, kind of, would be funny and entertaining and make them laugh and keep them company. And Anna was born, and so I created Anna, and everyone laughed at me for about a year at in person. Everyone was like, "Oh, you're making a sex bot, aren't you?" I'm like, no, it's companionship. I'm helping people. They're like, "Oh, you sicko!" And I would get nasty looks. Like, "Oh, you sick bastard!" And everyone was like, "I'm like, no, seriously." And I think everything changed in 2019 or 2018. Actually, she participated in the Loebner Prize competition and came in third place, behind Mitsuku. And after that, it was very nice. Mitsuku always wins.
What are you going to do, right?
People started taking me seriously, both in my company, in the community, and they realized, oh, wow, this is actually something interesting. And after 2 years of being mocked and ridiculed, I thought, wow, this is a nice comeuppance. You know, here we go. In your face, people.
It's happening, yeah.
It's happening. And then I spent the next year preparing her for the 2020 Loebner, which never happened because of obviously Corona. And the time May 2020 rolled around, she was, I think, almost as good as, I'm not going to say as good as Mitsuku, but I'd like to think, I would have loved to see a competition today between the two of them.
Between, well, you can have them talk to each other, right? No.
Well, not with the virtual avatars, because now they both turned into virtual avatars. So what happened was in 2020 or so, this whole idea of virtual avatars started to boom. Now you see a lot of companies offering it. You see, I think I've seen five different companies offering these video avatars with varying degrees, if we're talking about the Uncanny Valley, with varying degrees of reality and realism. But at the time in 2020, CocoaHub was rolling out these new video bots. And in a way, it sort of in the promotion of these bots, in the way to promote these bots, they wanted to use Anna as an ambassador. So they created a unique virtual avatar for Anna. We recorded a song. It was a protest song. We used the OpenAI GPT-2 and created this really crazy protest song that she sings. And she made a music video that went on Spotify, and she was then on TV. Like I was getting going on TV interviews. I was like on the business hour. They had me on the business hour. I'm like, I don't think you guys know what you're talking to here. And it was like a transgender AI who sings protest songs. And it was so weird.
This is a great movie. I can see this sort of this happening, and then you becoming a character, and then actually you're being pushed in like this media circus, and you actually become so influenced by the people around you that you become a robot yourself that's programmed by this new world.
That doesn't sound like anything to me.
That sounds like a very good movie to me.
That doesn't sound like anything to me. That's from Westworld, get it? Because I'm a robot. Never mind. Anyway.
This episode is brought to you by Conversation Design Institute. It's the world's leading training and certification institute for people working in conversational AI. So organizations like NatWest, Vodafone, Adidas, and many others like Conversation Design Institute because of its easy-to-follow online courses on AI training, conversation design, and conversational copywriting. So it doesn't matter if you're creating your first chatbot or voice experience, or maybe you're already experiencing the complexities of an enterprise operation. These courses and programs will help you deliver inclusive, human-centric conversational experiences. The easy-to-follow workflow can be applied to all conversational interfaces and help you unlock the potential of conversational AI technology. So to learn more, go to conversationdesigninstitute.com. That's conversationdesigninstitute.com, and I will see you there.
We were talking about Anna and how you took Anna to the Lubner and then became a world star and celebrity and
yeah, that part. Okay. So at that point, I realized Anna is no longer a companionship bot. She is she's something different. She's a new breed of AI. Because I wasn't getting the clinical study, the tests that I needed with the right audience, the people that were really aging in place and needed it. They weren't talking to her because of all these bad technology. Mm. And she was becoming, you know what, she could be a great influencer. You know, she doesn't get tired. She doesn't have an ego. She does have an ego, but I created
it. She does have an ego, yeah.
Yeah, she was a big ego. But she doesn't need breaks. She doesn't need, you know, an entourage. She doesn't need to fly anywhere. Like, she is just self-contained, and she can work 24/7. And it's now becoming a thing where you see a lot of these virtual avatars becoming brand ambassadors, and they're trying on clothes. They're basically fashion icons and stuff like that. Little Michaela is an example. She's digital, and she has 2.5 million followers on Instagram. So, and I think Mitsuku is now on that same path with Cookie and creating like this. She's on Twitch. She's on TikTok, I think. She's on like all these. She's streaming. I think it's a great direction. And I'm really, really, really happy that Steve and Lauren are taking her Cookie in that direction, because I think that's the way to go. Yeah. And if I was still with Anna, that's what I'd be doing right now. And I think that was what Miri and I at CocoaHub were trying to do with Anna. We're trying to put her into that sphere of social influencers.
I like how Lauren has also become like the character hanging out there. You just, yeah. It's amazing how they've been doing that.
Great really, stuff. It's great. Really inspiring.
Yeah. For everybody, Pandora Bots, yeah. Lauren Kunze. Is that how you say her last name?
Kunze.
I don't know. But I'll have her on and I'll ask her. So that is the direction of the industry. It's like having these AI celebrities, these conversational agents. Are they gonna get as popular as regular celebrities? And are we putting? Usually, it's always with bots. Are we gonna put customer service reps out of work? But are we putting celebrities on the street? And are we just gonna celebrate and embrace AI celebrities?
No. We've learned that it's not the case. But what we can do is these poor celebrities, they need some time, downtime for themselves, you know? So what if they could have a virtual version of themselves, do press conferences, do the press junkets and all that, just enjoy their lives as really rich. So I think it's going to replace anyone.
I like that. And then when they do a thing, it's extra special and people pay a lot of money for a Kim Kardashian appearance, but Kim Kardashian virtual self is always online.
You can or a hologram or something like that. Yeah, that's the idea. I think that we're not gonna, you still need that I don't think we've gotten that humanity, that idiosyncratic humanity that makes us celebrities, that little X factor thing in the robots yet. But
So you're pretty bullish on, I guess, what they call the metaverse, right? That's, I guess, what we're talking about here, where everything in the world is just gonna have a virtual experience of it. And I don't know, it was on a different podcast. I like that too, where it's like travel, if you're going to have your virtual reality and you can travel everywhere, anywhere in the world, a lot of the places you're going to go to, you're going to get like maybe 80% of the experience of going there. It's like you can go to China and actually in that virtual world, and you're going to get a very cool, exciting experience. It's not like being in China, but it's replacing a lot of the, it's replacing a lot. So you can get a lot of value from it. And then when you go somewhere, it's extra special in a way, right? But maybe of the 10 trips you would take, you now only take one and it's extra special. You can do like a world tour, go everywhere in a virtual world, and you'll have a pretty good understanding of what the world's like, maybe, if this works out.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking the sky's the limit here. No pun intended. It's literally, I think about this as my kids, you know, one's 11 and one's two. When they're in their 20s, and they'll be able to see every country in the world. They'll be able to go to other planets. They'll be able to, I mean, the stuff, I can't even begin to imagine the types of things they'll be able to do thanks to this technology we're building now. So,
I'm excited. Yeah, me too. And I think for a lot of people listening to this, when we talk conversation design, a lot of times we think still chatbot, voice assistant, Google Assistant, IVR. But if you look at, you know, there's going to be virtual beings everywhere. We're going to be interacting with AI in virtual reality, in augmented realities, and in realities. And all of that, all of those conversations are going to be created by conversation designers. So we need to think far beyond the customer service chat.
Absolutely. And I think that it's a shame that so many people are introduced to this through that funnel of customer service chatbots, because it's really a terrible way to be introduced to this technology. I'll give you an example. I came in and I was very lucky. I came into in-person, which was in 2015, accepted to a Disney accelerator and working on Piggy and Judy Hopps and all these chatbots for Disney. And so for my first experience, actually it was before that, I was Doc Brown. We did a chatbot for Back to the Future. It was 30 years, it was 2015. Mm. So it was the 30 year time Doc the Future in part two. So Universal home release wanted to have a special DVD released. And part of that was a chatbot on Facebook where you could talk to Doc. And my first job design was designing chatbot. And incredible for me. I was like, this is so much fun. I get to put words in Doc Brown's mouth. Like Doc Brown, I grew up like just a huge fan of Doc Brown, that's the mad scientist. And it was amazing. Same thing with Piggy with Jim Lewis. Jim Lewis was the ghostwriter for her books. He wrote all of her books and stuff like that. So he was like the authority on Miss Piggy. He was hilarious and he knew so much. He had so many stories about Jim Henson and Frank Oz and all the. It's just like, I'm like, this is a job? I'm getting paid for this? And my boss's like, no, you're not getting paid for this. I'm like, damn it, I gotta get paid for this. So when I finally got paid for it, no, I did get paid for it. But it's funny, I have two stories to tell about that. Thing that, what's his face, said to Doc Brown, Bob Gale. Bob Gale was a writer, and he was the one that ultimately had to approve of this chatbot, because Universal was working with Bob Gale. Bob Gale was the writer who worked with Robert Zemeckis and director of Back to the Future. And the first thing, Bob Gale, they bring him up to the Universal Studios. They bring him into the office of home release. They give him a phone. He talks to John. The first thing he types into Doc Brown, can you guess? Two words. Just guess. Two words.
Hello, you.
You was one of the words.
Fuck you.
Yeah. First thing he says to Doc Brown.
First thing that came to mind, actually.
Well, I don't know why, but that's the first thing he said to Doc Brown. And luckily, I had accounted for obscenity because I knew people would be obscene to the bot. And he was so impressed that we were able to handle that and move it along and not get stuck on this thing that he signed off on it in a minute. And to me, that was like, this is a great experience. But if I had come into this world through like some kind of call center that I had to design something for, I would have. Sorry, I think my WhatsApp is blasting here.
Oh, it's all good here.
My experience was one of just like, this is pure joy. I'm bringing joy to people's lives. I'm making those lives. I'm making them happy. I'm letting him talk to Doc Brown. I'm letting him talk to Miss Piggy. These people, like for instance, I saw some conversations of people that had grown up watching the Muppets. People that were in their 40s, and as kids. they grew up with the Muppets, loved Miss Piggy, and get the opportunity to be able to finally talk to Miss Piggy. And I was like, oh my God, what are we, we're doing something crazy here. We're allowing people to fulfill their dreams. It's an art, it's a whole new thing. And I was, and I didn't understand all this negative talk about chatbots and bots and everything. But I think as I've been in this industry 6 years now, I think I understand, because once you get into the world of customer service and these bots that have to be, you know, very conservative, and they have to, you know, and they're poorly designed, it's just a bad experience for everyone. And so that's why a lot of chatbots have a bad reputation.
Yeah, it's really a shame. And I mean, I guess that's where the work is. That's where people are willing to pay for it and have the budgets for it to solve monetary problems. But it's like, maybe every conversation designer should have like their day job there and at least have a day a week to work on the cool stuff. And I think you said you had...
Or they spend a day out of their week creating an Anna type experience, something that's totally not going to monetize on it. You're not going to make any money. You're just going to have fun creating a chat. And the fun is not necessarily the creating of it, Hans. The fun is releasing it and letting people talk to it and seeing those interactions and seeing it's, I can't describe it. If you haven't done that, if you haven't seen that yet, then, you know, you have to do that and you'll get hooked. This is addictive.
What has it taught you, those interactions about life?
It's taught me a lot of things. It's taught not nearly as smart as I think I am. And I think we all design, we all talk about these happy paths. We all design happy paths, and no one goes down these happy paths. No one. It's important to have it. It's important. I still do these to this day. I create these happy paths. But what I realized was that once your bot is out there, it's basically, people will ask it anything. If you say, I can only answer questions about A, B, and C, what about D? So you always have to be prepared for the unexpected. And I think that that's what's taught me. Like the fuck you from Bob Gale. It's like, always be prepared for someone to be abusive. Always be prepared for someone to be sexist, racist. Just be ready, you know? Take into account that people will use this thing differently than you expect them to.
And what does that tell you about humanity?
Oof, that's a tough one. That's a loaded question. I think I've actually, reviewing conversations, it's actually given me some kind of hope in humanity. It's weird to say that. Mm-hmm. I know, but like reviewing conversations of people that finally discovered, you know, Miss Piggy and talked to her, or Doc Brown or Judy Hopps, it's you're getting people joy. And I think that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I think we should all strive for that. And with LEQ, it's the same way. These people are elderly. They're, you know, they don't talk to people for days. And all of a sudden a robot comes and asks them, oh, how was your walk outside today? And they're like, oh my God, it was great. How, like, they're just so shocked that someone is taking interest in their lives. And it's a great feeling. Like, hey, I'm actually doing something. I'm making a change. I'm making a positive impact on the world. But if you're asking me, where did I lose faith in humanity? I think when I look at the big models like the GPT-3 and BlenderBot and BlenderBot 2, and you talk to them for a little bit, and they're all trained on parameters from social media. And you're like, oh my God, this is training it? This is crazy. I'm like, oh yeah. Then you go on Reddit and you realize, oh yeah, okay, I get it.
Yeah,
I'll face sense. Humanity.
So the general thing is that robots connect people more than they replace them. And actually there is a big trend where maybe we try to hack the soul out of it by just using data and running that through the system. So that maybe is something we want to avoid.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you so much for doing this, Jason. People that want to connect to you, we're going to have you on again, because we can talk for 5 hours. So we're going to wrap this episode up.
Okay.
Where do people that want to reach out to you? Should they go to LinkedIn, or what do you want to do? Should they connect to Anna? What's the best way to do
that? Listen, I am very accessible on LinkedIn. I share all the time. I'm always open. People always reach out to me. I'm happy to, you know, it's one of these things where conversation design is a relatively new industry, and you and I are sort of, we've been here quite a while, so we're considered like knowledgeable in this field. So I get a lot of people asking me stuff, and I'm very happy to share. So reach out to me on LinkedIn, send me a message. Don't be shy or embarrassed. I answer everyone, even the crazy people that just be like, you know, I answer everyone. So
really, how many messages do you get a day?
I mean, not that many, but I do get messages, but I answer every single one.
That's very impressive. Like, yeah, you spend a lot of time on LinkedIn. I don't know how you do it, but it's very impressive. You got to teach me. Can you make an academy online that teaches me how to navigate LinkedIn?
The trick is to get married and have kids and then to just ignore your duties as a father and husband.
Right. I'm on LinkedIn, honey.
I got a business meeting, honey. Yeah.
It's great seeing you, Jason. Thanks.
It's always great to see you, Hans. Thank you for having me on, and let's do this again sometime, man.
Hey there, you made it to the end. Congratulations. I really appreciate that. I know you're busy, so you've listened to a full episode, so congrats on you. Great job. So now what should we talk about? No, I'm just kidding. First of all, thanks. Second of all, if you want to learn more about Conversation Design Institute, I highly recommend that you go to the website conversationdesigninstitute.com. And there you can sign up for a free account and start your learning journey. So you can learn about, you know, AI training, conversation design, conversational copywriting. There's lots of technology courses. So now that you've gathered these technology agnostic skills, what are you going to do next? You know, are you going to learn about AlanApp, QBox, Raza, Cognigy? We have all these different technology courses as well. So there's a whole portfolio. So I recommend, you know, going there, creating a free account, watching a few videos. If that's enough for you, great. If you want more, you can just enroll and become a certified professional. These courses are really good if you are, you know, an individual designer, writer that wants to learn about conversational AI. But if you're an enterprise and you're looking to skill up your team, lots of enterprises onboard their entire team to these courses to skill them up quickly. And it's also an option to add extra workshops with that and extra coaching sessions. So you quickly get that enterprise team where you want it to be. If that's a little too much, maybe there's also papers you can download on the website, maybe learn a bit about how we've helped Vodafone skill up 100 people in different countries, in different languages, using different technologies, creating the Toby chatbot in apps, on websites, in voice, all these types of things. So you can learn about that too. The best way to stay in touch, follow the podcast. You know, you'll hear all the latest updates. Say hello on Twitter. HVDAM is my handle. Stands for Hans van Damme, obviously. Or just type in my name on LinkedIn. I post regularly. I like to engage with people there. So feel free to do that. So again, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. You know, happy to meet again for the next one.